Final presentation is again some of the same folks from my earlier one. And what we're doing here, which I think in one sense ties the presentations together in a very interesting way, is to look at the neighborhood context of homelessness. Over time, homelessness research has kind of moved back and forth for being research about economic and housing variables to a long period of time where I would characterize it as much more related to psychiatric epidemiology, and then with a broad number of shelter studies as we tried to figure out who the homeless were, to a focus currently more on intervention studies and what do we do about it, including the current emphasis on ending chronic homelessness, and I won't make any editorial comments on that at this point. But we're also seeing now a beginning of looking back to some of the issues that were discussed historically, but have, with new emerging new technologies and improvement in our ability to collect data, have once again found their way back into our discussion. In particular, for this talk, we're going back and we're looking at location. Anyone who has who has owned a home has heard it's location, location, location. But one of the questions that emerges kind of on the edge of the literature is, where are our shelters relative to where are our people becoming homeless from? And Van Maas has talked about the potential for homeless shelters to be warehousing. And we know that one of the trends in the 1980s were exceptionally large shelters where people came from all over an environment. In St. Louis, what we found about in the early 2000s were that none of the primary shelters were located where the telephone into our crisis from the top 10 zip codes. And so what we're doing in this study is we are looking at this same issue in terms of testing Van Maas's assertion that homeless people are geographically warehoused. And the questions are really focused on the issue of where are people becoming homeless from versus where are they getting housed to. So it's not just a question of kind of the way it's been looked at in the past is a filtering in, but perhaps the more important question is what are the opportunities where they are for housing. This is particularly important as most of us would have no great difficulty believing that homeless people have difficulty with transportation, particularly in environments where there is not a great deal of infrastructure. As one of 20 years ago, one of my clients said, cars are for sleeping. And so the question of where do people get housed becomes critically important when any amount of spatial distance becomes involved. This draws on Carol North and my Suncoda study, which is 400 subjects randomly selected from shelter and street locations in St. Louis, Missouri. And what we did was we followed them for 2 years, looking at where they were at the time of recruitment, which is they were literally homeless, and following at 1 and 2 year interviews. The other thing that we did was ask them to locate where they were living when they became homeless. So we're looking at the location where they became homeless from, where they were when we recruited them when they were literally homeless, and what happened to them when they became housed over time or didn't. What we did was we geocoded all of these locations and mapped it using 2000 census data. I want to give one, again, I'm not the geographer here, but I wanted to mention a couple of things. One of the more interesting variables that we used, or was more interesting to me, was what was called the Townsend Material Deprivation Index. And I want to explain what that is, because I think it's a very succinct measure of how we think about neighborhoods. And what it is it's a Z transformation of several neighborhood characteristics. The density of population, which is crowding, the proportion in the census reporting unemployment for that tract, the percentage without a car and the percentage of properties that are rented rather than owned. So when we talk about material deprivation, that's what we mean. Those are the variables that go into it, and I think that's also important. These are the valid addresses. One of the interesting things that happens over time is you discover that you ask anyone who's tracked homeless populations and asked for addresses and locations has the frustration of discovering that many of the addresses that you're given don't exist, either are obviously incorrect, or are, if someone is somewhat disorganized, simply the block doesn't go that far, there aren't that many apartments in the building, etc. So these were only four addresses that we were able to verify using extant data on addresses. We were very conservative in that, and in terms of where they became housed, both attrition and actual address given became very uncertain. So there's some decrease in the number of units. This is just one of the things about GIS is it's really nice because it gives you the data and you can really talk about it. This is the recruitment places. It's 80% in shelters, and those are the bigger red blobs, and the others are street locations, which were I can talk about more later, but which were randomly generated and recruited from. So this is just a picture. Here is the a map of where people were last housed, and we want to put this up because one of the things that I'll talk about a little bit is why I'm going to talk more about median and mode rather than mean, because what you see is a centroid with a large distribution as far away as San Diego, Seattle, I think that's Tallahassee, and Dallas. So that it's mostly centered within the city units in St. Louis, but unevenly distributed across the country. So here are the maps, the three time points. In particular, the distance between when they were last housed to where they were recruited, where they were homeless, is the median distance is 3 miles. So there is some distance traveled on foot. That's fairly substantial. And then looking at, and what I really want to point out in this slide is then they travel another 2 miles. But what's most interesting, what I want you to focus on, is this here. So they are homeless, they move into the shelters, and the distance between where they're housed and where they were originally homeless, the median is zero. So they end up returning back as near as can be told, functionally no difference between where they're homeless from and where they become housed at. And this really is also demonstrated when you look at the centroids. Again, the housing is broadly distributed across neighborhoods. Where they're homeless is very narrowly distributed, and it becomes broader again as they're housed. So the story is really becoming clear. And what we mean, well, at least clear to someone who's looked at this data a lot and wondered what's going on. And the story is very interesting, because if you look, what you see is the place they became homeless from, where the shelters are, the median income of the shelter neighborhoods is in fact lower, the housing price is higher, there's a higher proportion of rental units, and a higher degree of deprivation in the shelter neighborhoods, not in the homeless neighborhoods. And when we turn it around and look from where they were recruited to where they become housed, these all remain significant, but are in exactly the opposite direction. So they move back to neighborhoods with slightly higher median incomes, slightly lower housing prices, lower proportion of rental units, and slightly higher neighborhoods. Now, I also want to point out that this doesn't make them good neighborhoods. In fact, they're moving from relative poverty neighborhoods to extremely poorer neighborhoods with fewer units overall. So these are differences rather than absolutes. They're not moving to suburbs, which is what one audience on campus when we presented this said, oh, so they're in the suburbs. The answer is no. We already looked at that, and this is why this slide is here. Is again, you can see, looking at the material deprivation, looking at the index, what you see are the bluer colors are the higher deprivation. And what you see is they move from light blue to dark blue, not from red or yellow to dark blue. So we're seeing them, so that's a very important caveat, particularly for policy people. They're not coming from strong neighborhoods, they're coming from relatively weak neighborhoods into much weaker neighborhoods. So, the thing to emphasize here is that the differences are all in becoming homeless and leaving homeless, not in where they are living when they are living stably. And that's really critical, because that kind of tells the story. That is, this paper is to test what we call warehousing phenomena. What we see is they are moving to a narrow set of shelters that are set in poverty neighborhoods from a broader band of residencies that are set in slightly less poverty. One of the things, though, that's kind of we were thinking about, and this is a very important piece, is we got into this study by going back to try and take pictures of some of the places where people were getting services. And what we found was when you talk about poverty and change in poverty, gentrification becomes a fairly important variable. Because as gentrification happens, it changes the compositions of the neighborhoods. Now, because we used one census set of data, we can't really say whether these gentrify or not, but potentially we think that that's an explainer. And as I said, this really does tend to support the warehousing explanation. That is, we want to get the homeless tend to be, and this is not an intentional policy. This is not meant to be an indictment of the St. Louis policy, but this is as it happens. The shelters are fairly close together, and that our assumption is, from no data, but based on having been in St. Louis, Carroll North, for more than 20 years, and I was there for about 15, is that this is a natural occurrence in some of the policies around centralizing services. So there's no, can't argue causality or not, but we do know that there's an association and wonder, and this is a challenge to throw out that comes beyond the data, but we think not so far, is one of the consequences of centralizing data, providing one-stop shops, is warehousing a consequence of the change in policy? Or conversely, is it a recognition? But in terms of the data, it suggests the causality goes in, this is an unintended policy consequence of putting multiple services together. What we're looking at now is we're actually looking at the housing themselves. I said the gentrification question has become very interesting. That is, where are, what is happening if we conceptualize homeless as people with a variety of risk factors, as has been established a billion times. Pretty much all of us find the same finding, disproportionate rates of both economic and psychiatric risk. We're looking currently at it at a single parcel level to look at the microeconomics of rental, of real estate impact on this as well. Who would rent to a homeless person who has the risk factors of the average homeless person? And what we're hoping for is to use both findings from this study and findings from the rental study, which we're currently doing, is to look at prevention from an economic standpoint and identifying high-risk locations where people with risk patterns that will look like homeless tend to occupy rental niches. I don't know if that was entirely clear, but it's a fairly complex, we're hoping, direction in doing primary prevention. That's it. Thank you. And
let me just make a comment that is not really about this work, and along the lines of what you were saying, there's also the finding, there has been a fairly consistent finding that black persons with schizophrenia are provided larger amounts of, not larger, it's more black people with schizophrenia use decanoate antipsychotics, long-acting antipsychotics than whites. And that has been seen as a disparity. However, depending on where you sit, you might think of it as actually as a positive thing. So absolutely, point very well taken, that the approach to the situation really colors how you assess the difference.
Other questions, comments?
David, I wanted to ask you a question about the geocoding study. How many people were still in shelter at the end of the study?
About a quarter of the sample were homeless across all waves. About three quarters had been housed at one or the other of waves, and about another quarter had been housed at both. Is that so? It broke into essentially 50% that were what we call that were housed and homeless at least once in follow-ups. Quarter that became stably housed, and a quarter that never got housed. And the quarter that never got housed were not included in the analysis, obviously. Follow up.
Did you find any of those who were back in shelters who have been housed in the interim and then gone back?
Yeah, about a little less than a quarter who had were housed at the first follow up but homeless again at the second.
So were there any that were
what we had were two opportunities for housing, and it basically broke into quartiles. And we have a paper that's in review just comparing those groups in terms of psychiatric and economic variables, and they're quite different, which suggests to us somewhat that, very tentatively, because it's only two follow-up data points from literal homelessness, but that chronic versus cyclical are the assumption that those are somewhat different populations in this study also looked very clear, in particular in terms of active substance use at each wave. A hell of a lot of work. Basically, we took about a quarter of our resources were spent in tracking. We've actually written a paper on that. We took everything that anyone had done over time and implemented it. So we were able to follow up about 80% of the sample at least once, and about 70% we have relatively complete data. But I don't know if we ensured compliance. We took really three primary approaches. One was, and we didn't present this data here, is we have relatively complete data on service use. So we know where they were getting services and could go there. And we had cooperation of all of the substance abuse providers, mental health providers, shelters, and public health settings in the city. So we knew where they were going. So that was one. The second was we had a lot of incentives for interacting with us. So we had weekly coffees and barbecues and newsletters, and so people could drop in. Obviously, we didn't interview them when it wasn't their time, but we maintained relationships. And the other was we had an active outreach. Our interviewers were all former providers, and we found that we we would stumble across them because we knew our interviewers knew where they tended to hang out. So we would. I remember St. Louis has a September barbecue fest, and we found six people that we had lost eating barbecue because we knew that they were giving away free samples. So some of it was just knowledge. And I think there are pretty good, across most studies, there are pretty good tracking methods, and we're all using some version of the same thing. So, I mean, we don't really know who we lose. They tend to be, at least in our study, somewhat more severe and somewhat more likely to have come to St. Louis from an outside of the area. But we also did some telephone interviews in Chicago and one in L.A. So we were able to find them through some contacts.
We found in our study that when we lose people,
piece that we had, and I suspect most people who work with more chronic populations, is we had a portion we couldn't follow up because of mortality. I believe of the 400, we had a dozen or so that passed on over the course of the 2 years. So we don't have the complete interviews, obviously, and we exclude those from successful tracking, with checking death records. But the high levels of mortality associated with homelessness is also quite important. We had some murders and some overdoses and some accidental deaths that were attributable to being homeless. Other questions? There's a couple of very interesting legal situations that have happened over that in the past several years. I've been an expert witness on a couple of them, so I can't tell you the city of the results, but one of the findings is that the police are violating homeless persons' rights with these what are legally arrests. And so there is, I'm not aware of it as kind of a public policy thing. I'm aware of it as having to go in and witness it. But that there is these things tend to be settled by the police, as those are actually illegal search and seizure or illegal arrest, depending on the policy. And as someone who was an advocate prior to and since becoming an academic, I suspect that that's part of very quietly what's happening at different urban locations. Like I said, I'm directly aware of a couple, and I've heard from others that there are a fair number of us who've expert witnessed in these kinds of issues, but that those are important legal issues, that those are not legal behaviors. Or at there's been no case law, but there's been a lot of judges ordering settlements saying you don't want case law. I suspect some of the advocates here in D.C. probably know a great deal more about this than I do. Well, unless they settle, that's a really important point, is if it depends if it's a class action suit and it's settled, then there's no case law. And that's really critical. That's why a number of these suits have been settled, because the judge has indicated that they're going to lose, so they pay off lesser or the same amount so that it isn't adjudicated. And I would be willing, I don't know the LA situation other than as an outsider, but I know that that's happened before, that the cities or the states or the systems don't want to be found negligent or violating civil rights, because that creates case law that can be used against them. So I would guess, please underline, I'm not a lawyer, but I would guess that there's a high likelihood that if they're good suits, they will be settled rather than go to case law. Does create law. I mean, that's the other piece, is these suits are being brought by the persons themselves, because they're the ones harmed. But you can then sue for the enforcement, which is where you hope, where you don't have to settle. There have been a few conferences. There was one in St. Louis a couple years ago that have looked at the legal aspects of enforcing policy. So it's out there. I don't know if it's here in public health, but I know that they've discussed it in legal communities at least a couple of national conferences. Well, any final thoughts? Well, thank you all, and it's a small but obviously interested audience.